Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Vinciane Desprez, associate professor of philosophy at the University of Liège in Belgium. Her new book, Living as a Bird, is just out in English translation by Helen Morrison through Polity Press. Birds sing to set up a territory, but the relationships between the bird, the song, the territory, and the bird's community are highly complex and individually variable. In her new book, Desprez explores the concept of territory from the perspective that situates philosophical work on human conceptions of other animals within historical and contemporary empirical research into bird song and territorial behavior. Following recent theorizing by ornithologists and ethologists, she critiques the popular view of territories as private property and birds as petit bourgeois who gain property rights, a conception grounded in European social upheavals starting in the 17th century. Instead, territories are zones of social interaction with one's dear enemies at the peripheries, where male and female birds alike are active participants in the shaping, reshaping, and sharing of neighborhoods bounded in song as well as space. This new translation by Helen Morrison makes Desprez's thoughtful analysis of songbird life accessible to an English-speaking audience. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Vinciane Desprez. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you, Carrie. Hello to you and hello to everyone.
Yeah. So this is a very, very interesting book, Living as a Bird. As an analytic philosopher, it's different from the way that I, you know, am used to, and probably many listeners are used to discussing issues of, you know, comparative cognition and comparative psychology and, you know, ethology and all those sorts of things. But, you know, it's very clearly informed by, you know, a lot of empirical research, as well as an interesting background in, you know, more continental philosophers, as well as, you know, some that I and others are more familiar with. So it was a very interesting way to think about non-human species and particular birds for me in particular, which I really enjoyed the whole way you kind of you know, discuss the whole issue of territory and how what territory is from the perspective of a bird and its neighbors, its species. So before we get into the details of the book, can you give us a little bit of background about yourself, right? How you came to become a philosopher and what your general interests are and how you came to write the book?
Okay, how I came to be a philosopher, you know, just because I liked philosophy when I was, you know, in the high school, I liked to read Freud and sociologists and psychoanalysis. And so I was thinking about that philosophy could be the right track for me. Unfortunately, after finishing my master's degree, I could not find a job because, as you don't probably know, in Belgium, they don't really teach philosophy back to that time, because it's not right anymore. But back to that time, they didn't teach philosophy during high school, which is not the case in France, which means that if you have a philosophy diploma in philosophy, you probably get very soon and for a long time unemployed. You don't find any job, which was my case. And finally, after 3 years of being unemployed, and I decided that I better get another diploma so I could find a job. And so I decided to study psychology as well, because I've been hesitating when I was young between psychology and philosophy. So I decided to go back to university. I was almost 30 years old, and I went back to university to study psychology, and I made my master's degree in psychology. What's happened in psychology is that I didn't really get interested by human psychology, which was normally what I should have studied because I wanted to be a clinician. But I discovered the work of ethologists, because we have some teaching in ethology and we have a lot of teachings also in animal psychology. And I decided that it was really what I wanted to study and what I like it. So finally, I didn't become a clinician, but I studied ethologist and psychologist of animals. Because of that, when I finished my master's degree, I had the chance that the Department of Philosophy of the University of Liège wanted to hire someone who has, by chance, both diploma in philosophy and diploma in psychology. And we were two. I mean, we were only two people having the two diplomas, and I was, they took me, and I began to make research in university. I was an assistant for the professor of psychology of philosophy, and I began to study, and I decided that as I knew pretty well ethology, that I could try to do something that really didn't exist really back to that time. I'm talking about the very early beginning of the 90s. And that as well as you can find philosophy of sciences in physics and in mathematics and in biology and in natural history, I could create some field that would be philosophy of ethology. And so I began to make research in that, and had a very, very great chance back to that time that during my master's degree, I read a lot about birds, because I decided to make my master's thesis about altruism in birds. And I read a lot of papers about birds, because about altruism in birds. And I discovered that most of the birds were behaving almost the same. You know, you can have a blue jay or a Mexican jay, or I don't remember all the birds I was studying. They all almost behaved the same. But one was very unique, and it was a bird called the babblers, which in Arabian babblers. And it was studied by an ethologist I didn't know back to that time, and it was not very famous back to that time, Hamoud Zahavi, which was living in Israel and teaching there. And he was studying babblers for almost 30 years. And when I read the papers from Zahavi, the babblers really didn't behave like other birds. They were dancing together. And Zahavi was saying in his papers that they were dancing to improve the trust and the reliability of the whole group and of the partners of the group. They were offering presents to each other. And they were trying to be altruists because it was for them the way to enhance the prestige. That's the way Davy was writing that. And you imagine in the beginning, at the end of the 80s, reading that about primates would have already been extraordinary, but about birds, it was really odd. It was bizarre. So I decided that as I could get a grant to make some field work to go outside in, to work in another laboratory, I asked the grant to go to Israel to visit Zahavi and to observe the babblers with him, because I was wondering, is it the babblers who are so strange, or is it the ornithologist who is really strange? And so I went to spend some time with him and with the babblers and with other researchers who were visiting him at the research station. And I spent a few months with the babblers in the desert of Israel, in the desert of Negev in Israel. And I studied birds, and I discovered that you could do field research as philosopher. And that really interested me. And so after that, I kept doing that most of the time.
Okay, well, this book certainly shows that. I mean, in a way, your interests are being vindicated by a great deal of new research into bird, you know, cognition and you know, further ethological investigation. So this book in particular is sort of about the concept of territory and how we should think about this concept, and then of course how it should be investigated, right, in, you know, empirically. So can you say a bit about the general topic before we get to details of how you do your analysis?
Okay, I can explain why I was I was not interested in the beginning by territories.
Okay, good. That's fine. Yeah.
So I was asked 2 or 3 years before I began this research, I was asked to write a little book for children. And I choose to write a little book about how animals inhabit the world. And it was about architecture and the way of living together or not together. All the way. And it was called Le Chez Soi des Animaux, being at home for animals. And after I finished the book and it was published, someone in the editor, the director of the Actes Sud collection where I was published, told me, why don't you do the same for adults? But it would not be about home, it would be about territories. And I really didn't feel like doing that because I was suspecting wrongly, I was suspecting that territories was such a heavy, loaded politically concept that probably I would find much more politics than what I would prefer to find. I don't know if it's clear, territory, if you read, for example, because I read that some books from Robert Ardre was, you know, making popular writing. So he wrote, you know, about the primate and so on, and man, the hunter and so on. And he wrote a book about territories, and the book was called, if I remember well, the territorial imperative. And it was showing that what we think about private property has long, ancient, archaic roots in animals. And but finally, what he does in doing that is saying that private property is the best things in the world since nature taught us to do that.
Interesting.
That's why I say that it's politically really problematic as a concept. So I was expecting ornithologists, you know, to have this kind of ideological path to study territory. So I was not feeling like doing that because I've never been a critical philosopher. I've always studied. I've always observed, I've always made research about ethologists or scientists who interest me really because they do nice, interesting, fascinating, great work. And I'm not the kind of philosopher who says, oh, you shouldn't do that, you know, kind of a joy killer with scientists, telling them how they should behave and how they should think. So I didn't want to take, you know, to take an issue where I should confront myself to the fact of being, you know, a kind of Jiminy Cricket in the Pinocchio story. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't think like that. Oh, look at that. That's what we call critical philosophy. And so I didn't want to do that. But Stéphane Durand was the guy at the edition, the editor, told me, you should insist, don't take it into account other, take the real ornithologists, not the people who make popularization of sciences. And the first ethologist I read, was Margaret Morse-Niles, because I chose her because she made in the 40s an history of the research that have been done until then, which was not a long time because the research began in England in the 1920. So it was only 20 years of researches. It was a little bit more, but mostly it was 20 years of researches. And what she said and the way she was talking about ethologists and the way she was talking and writing and explaining how did they work, how did they think and so on, made me really feeling more comfortable about that, because I noticed that they were so cautious. They were saying, okay, when a bird is territorial, it's really not the same as when a human becomes territorial. This is not the same stuff. This is not a problem of private property. For human, it might be a problem of private property, and not all humans in plus. But this is not the problem. They have a lot of other problems, and they try to resolve that with defending a territory. And so I felt better about that, and I decided to read all these ornithologies since the beginning of the story, which means I read first Elliot Howard, who was the first to really explored this field. He wrote a very nice book about territorial birds. And I discovered fascinating ornithologists, very clever people, very full of care, full of attention to the details, and full of attention to the details that make birds being different from each other, which means not only different from species to species, but even different from birds to birds, which was pretty new. I didn't think that happened so early in the history of ethology. That's the way I began.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So yeah, because one of the interesting comments that you make in the book is that this whole idea of thinking of bird territory or non-human animal territory, mm-hmm. As a kind of a correlate of the human private property ownership construct, and mm-hmm. the idea that somehow, animals are like these petite bourgeois property owners,
exactly.
Which I thought was very amusing. But it's also, in a way, it is very true that mm-hmm. we tend to think about territoriality as a question of ownership and, rights of possession and, seizing a communal land, right? I mean, all these things are very, very human and historically established. And one of the important points you make at the very beginning is that this whole idea is extremely impoverished and just, just kind of misunderstands what is going on with birds and their relation to their territory. Could you say a bit about how you think that particular idea is just badly mistaken?
Okay, the first thing is the problem was also that the conception of property, private property ownership that we have here, I think about us, modern, as Bruno Latour would say, is that it's a very pretty recent conception of property. It is from the 17th century, beginning of the 16th, 17th century. And it seems that back to that time, before that time, the conception of property, of private property, was pretty different. It was considered as not as individualistic property, but as something that was the product of the sharing. And in the 17th century, we have this big drama, this tragedy, what we call the tragedy of the enclosure that happened mostly in England, but also in France and mostly in Europe, that people, that the private property, I mean, that most of the land has been, which were common lands until there, people were making the cows grazing together, the sheep grazing together, and the water and the forest and the woods and so on was common property of village, of collective. And after the 17th century, most of the land has been, expropriated from people and given to private owners. And the law changed it completely. And the philosophy of property changed it completely, which means that what we consider as property or as territory today is suddenly from the 17th century, as in its local, its modern European, American, European conception of property, which means that animal in any case couldn't have by any chance the same conception of property. We cannot imagine that they have been, influenced by the 17th century philosophy of property, which means that the conception of property is very different from, it's not even a property. The territory is mostly, first of all, I would say, a making. A territory doesn't exist. It exists only in the continuous making. And this making is very interesting to observe. It is by singing for birds. Here, I'm not talking about mammals, but for birds, birds is making its territory, which means, let's take an example. Let's take a bird, because all birds are not territorial, of course. Let's take a bird that is seasonally territorial. Okay, what blackbird, for example, what will we do? So you see him, or her, but mostly males are territorial. Females are sometimes, but less often than males. They have other duties to take care of. And you are at the end of the winter, for example, you are probably mid-February because the day are going, are getting longer and longer pretty fastly after mid-February. And the birds normally live in a sort of collective, sleeps together, eats together, live with companion, and so on. And now, in mid-February, they begin to go away from the group, each of them, each male, find a place, can be big or little, it's what we call a territory, and begin to make a sort of, how would you say that in English, to choose a tree or something high and just stay there and sing. And in the beginning, 10 minutes by hour, and after that go back to the group, and after that go back to the territory and so on, and sing repetitively. And begins to fly over the space, like if it would be, this bird would do some painting, some invisible painting with this flying. It's really funny to see. And after a while, he does it more and more often. And eventually, what's happened, that he's finally stay alone in the territory, and he prevents any other bird to come in. What the ornithologists call the frontier, the border, after that they will call the periphery after the 60s. Another interesting theory came, and they wouldn't say border or frontier, but they would say periphery because it's not a real border. But back to the beginning of the research, they were talking about borders, and it really defends any intrusion into the territory. So if another bird come in, there will be a fight. That surely will be a fight until the intruders leave and let the resident alone. And that's what this kind of observation, they are so, bizarre, because normally these birds, during the winter, they're so quiet and they get along together and they have good relationship, it seems, and so on for the for the social, the very social world. And all of a sudden, they seem they cannot stand anymore each other. They cannot support. I mean, they cannot accept to be near each other. This is, and so this is what Elliot Howard decided to study, because he says this is the territorial behavior. And it's funny because two or three observers did the same observation at the end of the 19th century, but the word territory did happen very rarely. But with Elliot Howard, it became a real field of researches.
So, I mean, this kind of leads to the very popular hypotheses, and these are ones that you know I would be familiar with, or that you know, a territory is basically conceived of in terms of, you know, a certain amount of resources. So there's a certain food supply. So you try to get a territory in order to secure a particular food supply. And of course, this is for breeding, right? You question that whole, you know, again, I mean, this is all about seizing certain spaces and resources in those spaces for oneself and for one's, you know, mate and you know, chicks or what have you. And you find a lot, you know, all of these sort of standard evolutionary explanations for what territories are for, you know, and how they operate, all are problematic in various sorts of ways. So can you explain the problems, or some of the problems, with these you know, very widespread conceptions of what the purpose of a territory is?
Okay. Let's say first that, for example, the hypothesis, which was, I think, the first hypothesis to be made, it was securing the food. But I think that his hypothesis might be true. Of course, it might be true. I mean, I won't, as philosophers say to ornithologists, you're completely wrong. You don't know anything about birds. So it would be funny, but it would not be okay, reasonable. But I think that we can formulate it in some ways that doesn't need to be a problem of private property. That is exactly how to say it. And we can say that it's not a problem of securing food like you would secure something that belongs to you, but securing a space where you're going to feed. Why? Because it is really, for some birds, really more dangerous to go feed outside of the territory than inside it. And for good reason. For good reason, because predators. And because if you go far away, you'd have to leave your chicks alone. And when the chicks are alone, what do? But they you know, they call. And so they call the predator. So it's really better to feed near the nearest possible of the nest. And so this is not so much a problem of securing the food as a private property, but securing a space where you are quiet and when you can go feeding without being always interrupted, you know. And so it might be a very interesting organization of, let's go feed the nearest of the nest that we can. And the second reason, so don't go too away because it's dangerous. You might meet a predator. Don't go away to your nest, because if you go away, the little chicks will scream and call the predator. And don't go away because your territory, you know your territory. Jean-Christophe Bailly, who is a French writer, says something very nice about territory. He said that the territory is the place where animals can hide. And he precises not only the place where animals can hide, but the place where they know where to hide, which is interesting because outside your territory, you don't know where to hide. So territory is finally, it's a place of security. And if you consider that this place of security is not a problem of ownership, finally, it's a problem just of organization of the, you know, the way birds are going to feed in the period, in the time, during the time where the chicks need a lot of food in plus. And so a lot of researches and a lot of foraging. So this is the first point. Other theories. What pleased me, I mean, if we say that instead of saying again that the bird is a petit bourgeois and wants to keep all the food, you know, like childish, I want to keep all the food for myself. I think that if we explain that, if we formulate that in such a way that makes the bird being social beings, but in some, when this time is the time of breeding and taking care of the chicks, the birds need to be quiet. They need to not to be with, they need that no one interfere in that story because they need to be quiet. They need to get the energy for doing the things they have to do and to be alert and to be vigilant and to be careful. And, you know, if you begin to fight all day long with other birds, of course the predator will come because he will be attracted by the noise and he will be surely successful because when the birds are fighting, they don't pay attention to what's happened around. So this is the first reason. Other reason has been invoked and they probably are true for some cases. And this is interesting. What I found very interesting in the theories of territory from all these ornithologists that they say that sometimes this theory is good for dead birds, and sometimes it's another one that would be explaining precisely all that bird or another bird. Which means that they say that when you have a territory, it doesn't have when you have a theory, it shouldn't exclude the other theories. All the theories might explain some cases or some species or some group or even some individuals. And so you have other theories that say that when they have a territory, male can attract females because they have to sing. And the female may be attracted by the song of the birds. So if you don't have any territory, it might be harder to sing because you might attract the predator and you might attract the fighting of other birds. Some say also that the female don't choose males, but in fact choose the territories considering the quality of territories, and that the male so males who have good territories might be more attractive to females, which might be also something interesting to consider, and also interesting to consider that it's what is the quality of the territory, and females are not petit bourgeois either. Maybe they don't choose the biggest one or where the most flowers or the most food in it or something like that. They also might choose, and this has been the hypothesis of some ornithologists, they also choose territories where males are quiet when they have been where they have already resolved the conflict with the neighbors. Because if they don't have a quiet male, a mature quiet male, the problem will be that they won't take care of the chicks correctly because they will be fighting the whole day with the neighbors. So females sometimes may choose a territory not only because the quality of the territory, but because they notice that, for example, the atmosphere between neighbors is a quiet atmosphere, and that they have resolved the first the conflict they had in the beginning of the installation in territories. So I don't know if for me, the most interesting hypothesis is the one from Fraser Darling and a little bit after him from Fisher. I think that is the most interesting. It's the most interesting in plus because it doesn't exclude any other theories, which for me is a good quality of a theory, that this theory may explain something and say, but automotive might also play a role. And the theory from Fraser Darling, which is very interesting, he said, so we are in the 60s now with Fraser Darling. And he says, you know, that he observed, he was a specialist, he has observed a lot of birds living in colonies. And he said, why do birds live in colonies instead of living, let's say, alone or living far apart from each other? And he says, because colonies bring to birds the stimulation they need. And in fact, actually, that is true. You know, if you see, for example, the bird, I don't remember the name, yes, Pink Floyd. Is it right to say Pink Floyd? You know, this pink. I know, for example, that in zoo, if they have Pink Floyd, I saw that, they give mirror to the group of Pink Floyd if they are not enough. Why? Because if they're not, I mean, if you have 10 Pink Floyds in a group, it's not enough, because they won't stimulate each other enough to make the biological cycle I don't remember the word, that the biological cycles cannot take place if they're not stimulated by other birds. And so, for example, in zoo, they put mirror in the front of the bird. So instead of being 10, they are 20 if they have a mirror, you see. And just so Frank Fraser Darling was interested in all these phenomena of the colonies of birds, because he says that finally, if birds in colonies need each other, and that's why they choose to live in colonies, or that's why natural selection make them choose to live in colonies, is because they need a lot of stimulation. And Franz Fraser Darling asked, isn't it the case of all the social birds? Don't they need to be stimulated, not only physiologically, but also socially, psychologically, and so on and so on? And he said that finally, territories, with all this fighting and all this meeting at the what we call the peripheries, isn't that one of the reasons territories has been chosen by natural selection? Because it brings the birth exactly two opposite constraints. It allows the birds to respond to two opposite constraints. The first constraint is, if you want to make a nest, you want to have chicks, if you want to breed with your female, you have to be quiet, and other birds shouldn't be interfering. So you need a territory. But in the same times, you need to be, because you are very social, because you are a social being, fundamentally, would say Fraser Darling, you need to still have social contacts, even though you need to be alone with your family. And territory is the perfect means to join the two constraints, because you can be alone and you can prevent other two from interfering in your life and your nest and so on. But in the same time, at the periphery, you can meet them. And he says that all this fighting, finally, is more spectacular than anything else, which was already observed by a lot of ornithologists. Margaret Morsnais already said in the Thursday that the most spectacular was the fight, less serious it was, that it was mostly comedians, actors, that it was, you know, pretend to be. And so Fraser Darling took that seriously and says, finally, they pretend fight, but nobody gets really hurt most of the time. And generally, the fight always ends in the same way. The intruders go back to his own territory and the residents stay home. And it's mostly, most ornithologists say that it's very rare to see one territorial bird being dispossessed from his territory after a fight. And so this is, and Fisher came and gave some more some more, give strong argument in favor of this hypothesis, saying that, for example, he noticed that in a lot of birds, not all of them, but in a lot of birds, he observed what he called the dear enemy effect. And the dear enemy effect is the fact that after a while, after the installation of territory, after a few days or a few weeks, the fights are calming down really, obviously. And the birds after that sing together, learn to sing the same song together, talk to each other, and fights are less and less occurring, less and less often.
Well, you mentioned this. I mean, this is sort of part of the theory you're talking about, but the whole idea of aggression, you've just sort of explained that a lot of it is really display, and it doesn't end up with one territory being, taken over by an intruder, at least not standardly, right? Along the same lines, so instead of thinking of all these, the fighting that goes on at the periphery as sort of genuine fighting, instead you following some of these theorists, argue that we should see this sort of behavior as actually social behavior, right? Where the periphery is really it's not a line between my property and your property, but it's a zone of possibility for social interaction, and in that sense, it's not at all a matter of stay out of my, just stay on your side of the fence and I'll stay on my side. It's more like this is where we can interact, even though I need this little part of, peace and quiet over here, but I also need to be interacting with you. So we never want that border to be firm. We always want it to kind of be fluid so that there's always something for us to do.
Yeah. I think that we could almost say what Thelma Howell would say about her sheep. Thelma Howell is a primatologist, a very, very, very interesting primatologist. She's retired now. But after that, she studied sheep, after studying primates for years and years and years, and she studied sheep after, because she asked a question I'm not changing of ID, but I'm just precising who is Thelma Howell. And she says, we say that primates are so much more intelligent than every other beings, that every other creature, that every other animals. And she says, but look, we ask them intelligent question. And what did we ask, for example, to sheep? But we ask them, how do they eat? Do mother love the children, the lambs, and so on and so on. And so sometimes, when she describes the sheep, the sheep she observed for years now, she said that sometimes when they conflict, the internal conflict, she says something very interesting. She says that sheep are saying to each other, in some ways, I cannot prevent myself to do what I'm going to do. But this doesn't mean that we are not good friends. And I think that that's why it's so hard to explain. It was, when the first ornithologists saw the conflicts between these birds, the territorial birds, they were so impressed because they fight so hard. But in the same times, after a while, they noticed that, in fact, it was no injured and no territory was taken away from its resident, not to say owner, let's try not to say owner in that case. And I think that they were rightly impressed, because when birds fight, they do it, you know. But it was, it would be as they would say to each other in some ways, we have to do, we cannot prevent ourselves, you know, we can help from doing that. But anyway, we still are good friends, or we can be good friends anyway. And so this explained that the fight at a moment will stop. So it's a very hard fight, but at the moment it will stop. And when will it stop? It's very interesting that ornithologists notice that. More the intruders comes near the center of the territory, less and less aggressive he is. And more, you know, he takes really the attitude of what we call in the theory of hierarchy in animals, the attitude of the dominated. And more he goes to the center of the territory he wants to intrude, and more dominated it looks. And the reverse, the contrary, is the same for the resident bird. More and more he's at the center of his territory, and more aggressive he is, and more dominant he looks. Which makes that finally, at the moment, the intruder will change his mind because the other one is so aggressive and he feels so uncomfortable. He feels, you know, he's taking the role so seriously of taking the role of the dominated that finally he goes back and leaves the territory. And the fight automatically stops, which means that it's nothing personal. If the birds make the intrusion, as soon as it passes the invisible line for us, which is the periphery or the border, as you want to call it, as soon as it passes on the other side, the fight stops completely, and those birds go and, you know, go live their life as if nothing had happened. Which means that it's nothing, in fact, nothing personal. It's just a problem of acting as a role because the territory is, you know, in kind, some kind of mobilizing or convocating this role. It's a kind of something that you have to do, mm-hmm. and you follow the script of the role.
Mm. So it's kind of like, it's kind of like the territory is a kind of a spatially encoded social hierarchy.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. The ornithologists exactly say that. Conrad Lorenz, you know, the famous ethologist, was one of the three founders of ethology, was saying that the territory and hierarchy has been the two way natural selection has made possible the regulation of population. I don't agree completely with that theory. But it seems that anyway, hierarchy and territory are very close. I mean, I wouldn't say like Lorenz that it regulates, I might explain for those who didn't read Lorenz. Lorenz says that if only the dominant may have some chicks for birds, for example, may breed. And if you need to have a territory to breed and to have chicks, in fact, the population will not grow more than in some limits. Why? Because only some animals, some male and some females, may reproduce. So the growth of the population is controlled either by hierarchy, because as only the dominant may reproduce, and by territory, because only the territorial who did secure a territory may reproduce. I don't totally agree with that theory, and a lot of ornithologists don't agree with that theory. But it's interesting to consider together that hierarchy and territory are some ways of some means and some very sophisticated means to organize the social life of animals, which is such a complex life that sometimes hierarchy may help them not to fight all day long for every decision that has to be taken.
Good. So let me ask you about song, because the book begins with a memory of you listening to a blackbird, I think, starting to sing, and obviously the song has a very important role in setting up territories, in establishing these what you call them, neighborhoods, and as you also put it, that not only does a bird possess, in some sense, or occupy a particular territory, at least for a time, but is also in a way possessed by it, and through its song. So could you explain the complicated role of song in setting up and sort of regulating territorial social relations?
Yes. Okay. This the idea of song. Okay, I will refer here to Jacob von Uexküll theories of Umwelt. Jacob von Uexküll, for those who didn't study ethology, is a biologist from German biologist. And the theories of Umwelt is a very, very interesting theory, saying that animals only perceive the world among them with some particular sensory equipment, which means that, for example, how do a tick perceive the environment if she doesn't see, but she can smell something, and she can smell something that only mammalian produce within their blood, this acid butyric, and so on. So you have the world in which each animal lives is not the same as the world human lives in, or the world of a cow is not the same as the world of a bee. The bee, for example, perceives some colors and perceives some things that the cow won't perceive, and the reverse is also okay. But that's not all. What von Uexküll say, and it's very interesting, it says that each animal only perceive what has signification for them. And the world is perceived only by the signification of each thing. So if something doesn't have any signification, for example, a ball or flowers for a tick doesn't have any signification, the tick will not perceive the flower, you see. The bees will perceive some colors of the flowers. So which means that the animal is a perceiver which can give signification to things around his world. From them, that von Uexküll says that when animals, animals leave mark, when dogs urinate or cats leave some odors, or when some ungulates leave some odors, for example, on some trees, von Uexküll says that it might be that animals give some extension to their body. And let's say that, for example, when a spider is waving its net, is it an extension of the spider's body in the space? It becomes like an extended body, So I was wondering, following them, that if we could not, and the other influence that gave me that idea is Deleuze and Guattari, 1000 Plateaus. We could consider that with the song, the bird is extending its own body in the environment, which means that it's, you know, filling the territory with its songs, exactly, which other means that the spider is filling the space with the web. That's the first thing. And I think it would be interesting to consider, because it would help us to understand why the birds sing so continuously. You know, if you don't agree, and mostly we don't agree, or ornithology don't agree, with the idea that the birds only sing to attract female, which is not true, because even when they have a female, they still sing. And even when they're not breeding anymore, that's the season of breeding is over, they still sing. So maybe with the song, they're doing something, not only talking to each other because they are social, not only communicating something, maybe communicating to other species of bird. We don't know, because we don't know much about interspecies relationship. But he's probably also making his territory, which makes me think that if the bird sings its territory, he's probably also sung by its territory, which means because the territory makes birds sing. And maybe the bird finally is territorial because also the territory give the birds the possibility, the will, the power, the motive to sing. That's the first thing. And after that, I discovered, because that's more recent research about song, that finally the birds also may probably like singing and like singing together. And maybe that what we assist is probably some sort of dialogue. You know, if you hear a blackbird, you see that it's really a dialogue with a lot of silence between the song. What we call silence, because I discovered after writing this book that some very recent discoveries is that some birds are singing, and after that we hear a silence. But Bernard Faure, who is a musician, compositor, and ornithologist, was recording birds and recently discovered that what we call silence was not silence at all, but birds during what we call silence are they talking to themselves, you know? They're doing so softly that we didn't hear. Yeah. And if he did hear, it's because he has, the recording machine amplified so much what's happened, that the silence finally was not a silence at all. And so they really ask, what do they do? Are they talking to themselves? Or maybe are they talking to each other, but in such a way, you know, like, I would say secret agent, you know, secret agent. They might be talking to some of them, the closer one, maybe. We don't know, but it's a lot of, I mean, we have a lot of very interesting hypotheses. And maybe they do both. Maybe sometimes they talk to themselves. And Max Luff, who is a very, very fine scientist of the crown, says that he already has heard crone talking to themselves, and they softly talk and nobody hears it. And he says it's like rain dripping or something like little bells. And he was wondering, and a few years ago, if they were not, you know, singing like children do. Sometimes they sing a little song for themselves when they feel alone or when they're scared or when they walk, like Dolores says, when they walk in the woods and it's dark.
Yeah.
This is it.
Okay. Well, we're actually almost out of time.
Yes.
Yeah. There's so much to really discover here. Before we close, I'd like to end with a question about what you are working on now. I mean, this book, it's just coming out in English, right? So what are you doing, sort of follow-up work on this book?
No.
Or have you gone into different directions?
I did go in different direction, because last year I wrote a book of novels about animals, and it's called in French Autobiography of an Octopus, And it's about wombats, spiders, and of course, common octopus. And it's novel, and it's very inspired by two writers. It's by Ursula Kerr Le Guin, the novelist. Because in The Compass Rose, it's a wonderful novel, which is called, I'll try to remember the title in English, with the author from the Acacia Seeds and all the excerpt from the Association of Tiro Linguistic. And she imagined that in some future, there are some linguists who will be convinced that animals are not only communicating, but they are writing, and they're writing poetry, literature, lyrics, and so on, each with its own kind of means. So the first discovering, she said, was that one ant has been writing on acacia seeds, and it was a pamphlet, do you say pamphlet in English? You know, a rebellion poetry, yes. Saying, let's eat the eggs and all the stuff. And it was so funny for me to read that imagine the Tiro language, Tiro from wild, sauvage, the Tiro language, that imagine that some scientists in the future could imagine that animals write and that they write poetries and so on and so on. That I wanted to keep this association of Tiro linguistic to make them work again. And the other idea was that the Nahrawi wrote in Staying with the Trouble, the last chapter, it's about the Kami, the communities of the Kami, that's imagining that some people would live with animals in some communities of multi-species communities in the future. And I took this both idea and I wrote three novels. About the first one, about spiders and how do they write and how do they discover the Tiro language? Did they discover that spiders were writing and giving message to humans? And the second novel was about wombats, because wombats build wall. That's the way the animals knows where their canals are. And the walls might be symbolic, I would imagine, like currents, like human currents. And the third novel was about that some fishermen found, in the future, of course, some potteries on which an octopus had been writing with its ink. And they have to translate it. So it will be a lot of adventure before translating in and coming into communities of like the Kami's communities and people living with octopus and so understanding them and so on. So that was the last project. And the next project I would like to work about, why is it so hard to lose an animal? Well, this is, and I would like to, so I begin a survey with people having lost an animal, dogs and cats mostly, because companion animals, yes, and asking them why is it so hard and how is it so hard. And after that, I would like to join that question to the extinction question, extinction question. Is it, why is it so hard and not so hard to lose all these animals? And I would like to cross these two questions.
Mm-hmm. Have you just curious, have you read Charlotte's Web?
No.
Is that available in French? I don't know. It's about a spider who writes with his web. I mean,
I didn't know.
That's a very crude way of describing it, but no, it's a very famous children's book, actually, in English. Anyway, what you were saying before about the writing reminded me of that.
Thank you, because I might read it. If it's in English, normally I should be able to read it.
Absolutely. Well, we're out of time, but I appreciate your taking the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy about this new translation. It's been a delight to talk with you and explore this whole, idea of territory and, you know, just think about it in very different, much more complicated and much more interesting ways than just, you know, the petite bourgeois conception. But yeah, so thank you very much. And
thank you for all your work.
Yeah, well, thank you. And good luck with the work that you're doing right now.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Vinciane Desprez, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Liège in Belgium. We've been talking about her new book, Living as a Bird, which is just appearing in its English translation by Helen Morrison, with Polity Press. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.